Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, January 4th, 2018. And here in California, Democrats are cooking up schemes to Trump Washington. On the GOP tax plan that puts a cap on state and local tax deductions, and on net neutrality. And while these may be acts that ultimately amount to political grandstanding, I welcome them. First, on the tax bill. As you know, the Republican partisan package that was rammed through the Senate and the House at the end of December was really partisan and punitive, especially at states that didn't support Trump for president, including my home state of California. And one of the real penalties, the punishments that was delivered to Californians, was this cap on state and local tax deductions. And because of Proposition 13, Californians pay less in property taxes than some other states on a prorated basis. But as a result, we have a personal income tax, and it costs money. It's about 9 to 11%, depending on your income category. And in the past, until this law was rammed through, we could deduct the amounts that we paid in state and local taxes from the amount that the federal tax is calculated on. It's a deduction. Well, that deduction has been capped at $10,000, and the average of 6 million California taxpayers was $22,000. That means the average taxpayer will be subject to tax on an additional $12,000. And that's not a tax cut, friends. No, it's not. So Kevin DeLeon, who has announced he is running against Dianne Feinstein, who's seeking her fifth term next November, he is the president pro tem of the state Senate. And this may be grandstanding on his part, but he's come up with a plan that other states are considering as well. And that would allow you to first write off the $10,000 that's now allowed under federal law. And then the remainder of your state tax obligation would be paid not as a characterized as a tax payment, but as a charitable contribution to the good old nonprofit state of California. Now, there are other precedents for this. Already, here in California, you can make contributions to the College Access Tax Credit, the Cal Grant Program, and a few other things that are deductible under federal law. They're not covered by this cap. So this is, in the view of its proponents, an expansion of that precedent. So the lawyers and the legal beagles say that this could pass muster. Of course, the Congress could then put a cap on charitable contribution write-offs, and this only really works for people whose Schedule A deductions, including property taxes and mortgage interest, exceed the now standard deduction of $24,000 for a couple. So it's a kind of gamesmanship. And De Leon certainly sees this as a way to impress voters about his aggressive advocacy for Californians, and that can be compared to the rather passive role of his presumed opponent, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Now, I want to add that there are other people running in the race, but the corporate media here in California is blacking out. Independent progressive Democrats, people like Pat Harris, who was the first to declare his opposition to Dianne Feinstein. And there are a handful of others who've also filed in that race, but the mainstream media ignores all except the professional politicians with millions of dollars in their campaign accounts. Now, there's another effort to basically negate the Federal Communications Commission's decision to revoke net neutrality. And a San Francisco state senator, Scott Wiener, has introduced a bill to require telecom companies doing business in California to guarantee equal internet access. His bill would also require the state to buy internet services from companies that practice net neutrality. Scott Wiener is joining similar efforts in New York and Washington State to write their own sets of rules guaranteeing equal access to the internet. Now, is this something that the FCC can declare is preempted by its federal regulatory status. Well, the San Francisco Chronicle talked to Tejas Narashanya, an assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Law. He formerly served as a special FCC counsel on net neutrality issues. He left the FCC a few years ago. But he said a few years ago, the FCC tried to preempt state laws in North Carolina and Tennessee involving restrictions on high-speed internet services. And a federal appeals court in 2016 ruled in favor of the states. And get this, here's some supreme irony. The current chair of the FCC, Ajit Pai, was on the commission at that time, and he supported the states' rights and opposed federal preemption by his agency, the FCC. And we'll see just how fast he can spin, like a fidget spinner, to come up with the reasons why we can't allow the states to undermine the role of the Federal Communications Commission. Also, I wanted to mention in passing, while I'm talking about issues from California, that the wine country wildfires that occurred back in October, scorching 140,000 acres, killing 31 people, 6,000 people lost their homes. It was devastating. And what was really, really creepy was that within hours of the breakout of these wildfires, there were people on YouTube and other spots on the internet who were not in California, who didn't have any local knowledge or evidence, who were freely speculating that, these fires must have been caused by weather engineering or by directed energy weapons from the Pentagon. And there were other bizarre theories advanced as well. And if you want to recap on that, I did a podcast in October with Mickey Huff of Project Censored. And we criticized those who were these armchair speculators. Well, the early investigative evidence has been revealed. There is no final conclusion from the state team that's investigating the cause of the fires. But all of the evidence points at PG&E. What I call the rogue utility, and the issues relate to untrimmed tree limbs that hit power lines, and also little devices on power lines called fuse cutouts, which may have attempted to restart the circuits that had been interrupted when lines were downed. And by trying to restart, these things put out sparks. And so a downed power line may have caused the fire. And if that didn't do it, these restarting devices may have done it anyway. So, again, I don't consider this conclusive, but I wanted you to hear that preliminarily the guilt will be aimed at the electrical utility. Yesterday, as I started the podcast, I reported that a bulletin from the Washington Post had alerted me that Paul Manafort, who's been indicted by Robert Mueller for money laundering, for failing to report and register as a foreign agent, Manafort has filed a civil suit against special counsel Robert Mueller, saying essentially that Mueller has exceeded the scope of his investigation by charging Manafort with issues that don't relate to 2016 in virtually any way, shape, or form. And as I pointed out, Manafort does have a legitimate beef here. And the way that Mueller is using the indictments of Manafort and his former partner, I think his name is Rick Davis, I get that name wrong. It's not Davis. It's... I'll think of what it is, but there's a Joe Davis listener who always corrects me when I get it wrong. And so, Joe, I apologize. The guy's name is Gates. That's what it is, Rick Gates. So anyway, Manafort, separate from Gates, has filed this lawsuit challenging the expansive scope that Robert Mueller appears to be operating under. And this could lead to discovery of any information between the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, who is managing Mueller because of the alleged recusal of Attorney General Sessions, Well, we may end up seeing documents that show that Rosenstein did give approval to Mueller to expand his probe. And that's where this stands. My view is that Manafort believes that by undermining the role of the special counsel and by demonstrating that his charges don't relate to the allegations of Russian hacking, Russian meddling, Russian interference in the election in favor of Trump, that this could help him in the court of public opinion. And I think that's probably a good calculation. Now, for a critical legal view from a biased perspective, I got an email of this article yesterday from Ian Millhiser. Now, he's a legal expert, and he is he's on the staff or a fellow at the Clinton-linked Center for American Progress. So consider the source. But he wrote a piece, Four Fatal Flaws in Manafort's Lawsuit, claiming Mueller can't prosecute him. And Millhiser raises a lot of important issues. And I think legally, Manafort does not have a really strong case. Millhiser points out that the lawsuit relies on regulations that explicitly deny Manafort a right to sue. And that is pretty substantive, and it gets in your face right away. And in this suit, they're arguing that the deputy attorney general in this case provided the special counsel with a specific factual statement of the matter to be investigated, and that statement in Rosenstein's order is not broad enough to delve into Manafort's business dealings in Ukraine. So then Millhiser kind of goes off the rails because he says, well, look, it's a dubious argument because Manafort wasn't just working for Ukrainian politicians and a Ukrainian political party. He was working for Ukraine's pro-Russia party. Now, being pro-Russia does not prove that Manafort was some sort of a tool of the Russian government. And if you look at the situation in Ukraine, where Manafort made millions of dollars from the kleptocrat, whose name is Yanukovych, I think it's Viktor Yanukovych, and clearly he is a corrupt guy, but I believe he was legally elected, and we have a history of corruption among the leaders in Ukraine, so he is hardly unique in that respect. But the whole issue was that the U.S. and NATO were trying to draw Ukraine into the European orbit, and Yanukovych, with the assistance of Manafort, was steering Ukraine back to the Russian orbit. And that led to the U.S.-backed coup of Yanukovych, which is still a messy and largely unexplained or covered-up affair. So I take the point of Millhiser that Manafort is probably not going to prevail in this case. But it will delay things, it will distract people, and as I said, it makes the public relations point that Manafort is not accused of the set of charges related to so-called Russian meddling. Now, in the Russia investigation, Rachel Maddow last night was breathless as she reported on a curious meeting in the office of House Speaker Paul Ryan. It was attended by that Deputy Attorney General I referenced, Rod Rosenstein, and the new director of the FBI, Christopher Wray. And we understand that the meeting was to resolve issues of a demand from the partially recused House Intelligence Committee Chair, Devin Nunes, for all of the FBI documents related to the information that they have dug up on the so-called Steele dossier. And all we know is that there was a meeting. Apparently a deal was struck. And Nunes says that he's going to get the documents that he requested. He had threatened to issue contempt citations against the FBI and the Justice Department for failing to produce the documents which he first subpoenaed back in August while he was allegedly recused. So this is a Republican-on-Republican fight, and it's not clear exactly what information will be shared with the Intelligence Committee. And so we will have to see how this plays out. Also, of course, the Fusion GPS op-ed continues to get some coverage and reaction. And the central issue there is the Fusion co-founders. They say that, they want the Republican-controlled three committees, House and Senate Intel and Senate Judiciary, to release the transcripts of 21 hours of their testimony before these three committees. And the chairs of both the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Committee, that's Senators Grassley and Burr, have said, well, you guys refuse to appear in public session. And if you want your spin of the events on the record, come on back and testify publicly. And it's fair to say, as I pointed out yesterday, that Fusion GPS is a an operator of information warfare. And the op-ed that they wrote, which is convincing to a lot of people, was heavily spun and had serious omissions. And as I pointed out, a lot of this could be easily corrected. And we could get actual facts, knowable facts, if we could learn what the actions of the FISA court were related to the so-called dossier. We know that the FISA court rejected the first request from the FBI or CIA for surveillance on Trump officials, Trump campaign officials. That was sometime during July. And then in a subsequent hearing, the warrants were approved. And knowing those dates could go a long way. Also, the date of when Chris Steele reported the crime in progress that he was witnessing to his counterparts, his old buddies at the FBI and CIA. So without those critical time date stamps, it allows them to play fast and loose with the sequence of events. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great folks like Mona Kobus, Anna Gordonier, Brian Massey, and Jerry White. Each of those people kick in $5 a month. You know, it's the cost of one hipster cup of coffee. Can you do that? Well, if you answered yes, why don't you do it? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the button that says menu, no matter what device you're using. Pull it down. Click on become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. And you've got options right there. And if you're a subscriber, later today, I'm releasing a new in-depth interview for your listening pleasure. And it is a powerful talk with the co-authors of a new book called What's Making Our Children Sick. Michelle Perro is a pediatrician, and her co-author, Vince Ann Adams, is a medical anthropologist. And they take a look at how industrial food, genetically modified foods, glyphosate or Roundup, and the damage done to our guts and to the microbiome, the bacteria that operate in our digestive tract, that really is central to our health. And, you know, I'm not an expert on nutrition and health, and I learned a whole lot from this book. And here's an excerpt from my conversation where Dr. Michelle Perro talks about how changes in diet improved drastically the condition of a young boy who had been diagnosed on the autism spectrum.
We are very careful in the book not to offer treatments but to show examples of how this can help children on the spectrum, which is now affecting so many kids, 1 in 43 boys, 1 in 68 kids. So and it's on the rise possibly as well. So children on the spectrum have some of the worst guts that I've seen, and that's actually reported in the literature. They have extreme inflammation of their guts. They are mostly gluten and dairy sensitive, and they have other issues as well as many digestive enzyme issues with bad absorption of nutrients. They have low levels of nutrients. They have many issues concurring focused on the gut. When you put them on an organic food diet, when you take out gluten and dairy, when you begin to do some restoration of the microbiome, when you restore their low nutrients, if you remove toxins and toxicants and heavy metals and other things that they may have, they get better. And it's remarkable. The one case that we talk about in the book is the boy with autism who had other things and, well, co-infections because they're sick, their guts are not working. That boy was the one whose dad, who had renal failure, significant renal failure, 20%. He was heading for dialysis, like his brother and his mom. And he lived in a heavily sprayed area in Central California. his renal function went from 20% to 80%. And he became off his hypertensive drugs, and his hypertension resolved. That was profound. So the child with autism got better. Dad got better. And so it'd be naive to say that, you know, I just changed his diet. That's not what I did. I did a lot with that boy over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the changes were remarkable.
That's Dr. Michelle Perro together with her co-author Vince Ann Adams. I invite you to listen to the full interview available to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and most of our outlets. A stunning setback for computer security because experts have discovered two major security flaws in the microprocessors inside nearly all of the world's computers. Now, there are two separate issues here. One is called Meltdown, and the other is called Spectre. But combined, they could allow hackers to steal the entire memory contents of computers, mobile devices, personal computers, and the cloud. Now, I, for one, have not stored a damn thing in a cloud storage system, iCloud or anybody else's, since they have offered it to me. And every day on my damn iPhone, they remind me that I have not backed up to iCloud in, you know, 6 months, 9 months, whatever it happens to be. And I'm not going to. And it's not just because I have a cache of nude photos that I don't want you to see. It's because I have enough storage of my own, and I'm not going to allow it to be vulnerable out there on the cloud. So, there is no easy fix for Spectre, which could require redesigning all of the processors. And for Meltdown, they are serving up a software patch that could slow down computing by as much as 30%. Now, Meltdown is a particular problem for the cloud operators, including Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. You know, Amazon has that $600 million cloud contract with the CIA. And using Meltdown, hackers can rent space on a cloud service, just like any other business customer. And once they are in, they can basically maneuver to grab information like passwords from other customers. And part of the reason is you know, there isn't really a cloud. it's just an icon, an image. It's a bunch of servers in these data centers that are scattered all around the globe. And because we share servers with other people, mostly strangers, well, that makes this an opportunity for nefarious actors. So the Meltdown flaw affects virtually every microprocessor made by Intel, and they offered reassuring words. Intel and other technology companies have been made aware of new security research describing software analysis methods that, when used for malicious purposes, have the potential to improperly gather sensitive data from computing devices that are operating as designed. Intel believes these exploits do not have the potential to corrupt, modify, or delete data. Yeah, but can they grab my passwords? Can they look at my nude photos in the cloud? We have lost our privacy. And speaking of that, one of our Christmas gifts was one of these Amazon devices. It's called a cone. And Alexa is the robotic voice that I talk to. And I have concerns about Alexa listening into my kitchen table conversations. But I have used it. It's kind of a fun little device. And I wanted to tip you off if you have Alexa in your home. You can ask her to load up the latest Peter B. Collins podcast. I tried it, and she did it without a flaw when I asked her for a friend's podcast from a radio station here in San Francisco. She couldn't find Michael Krasny. Anyway, you can check that out at your own peril. Donald Trump has decided to extend the damage and the exposure of Michael Wolff's new book, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House. It was a big story yesterday. We covered some of the juicy gossip that came out of Wolff's book, the he said, the Bannon told Trump this, and Trump told Roger Ailes that, and blah, blah, blah. And it's juicy, it's ugly, it's embarrassing. So why would a thin-skinned president decide to get his libel lawyer to demand that the author and publisher cease and desist all activities related to the dissemination of this book and its contents? I mean, this is the kind of free publicity that the networks gave Trump to help him win the presidency. And I'll just add a footnote. He didn't really win, but you know. So the author, Wolf, and Steve Rubin, president of Henry Holton Company, got a cease and desist order. So did Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon ceased and desisted on satellite radio last night. He said that Trump was a great man. And he authorized a statement that Steve had the honor of working in the White House and serving the country. Oh, wait a minute. That's Trump's tweet. Let me read that to you in full then. Steve had the honor of working in the White House and serving the country. Oh, this is Don Jr. Pardon me. Unfortunately, he squandered that privilege and turned the opportunity into a nightmare of backstabbing, harassing, leaking, lying, and undermining the president. Steve is not a strategist. He's an opportunist. And the Trumps are making sure that we continue to hear the juicy gossip that Michael Wolff has collected and is now distributing. Isn't that brilliant? And in the midst of this food fight with Bannon and others, Trump yesterday abruptly shut down the Voter Fraud Commission. You know, he had Chris Kobach, the guy who designed the Republican voter suppression schemes that did work in 2016. He made him Mike Pence's number two on this commission. They were supposed to ferret out the millions of fraudulent votes that were cast by illegals and others, according to Trump. But, of course, there's no evidence of that. It's mostly a myth. And yesterday, Trump said that despite substantial evidence of voter fraud, many states have refused to provide the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity with basic information. Rather than engage in endless legal battles at taxpayer expense, I signed an executive order to dissolve the commission and have asked the Department of Homeland Security to review these issues and blah, 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 blah. Well, on one level, this is good news because the promotion of voter fraud obscures the real issues of election fraud. And that's what we saw in 2016. As I've said on many occasions, Hillary Clinton won. She definitely won Michigan. She most likely won Wisconsin. And Pennsylvania is kind of a wobbler. But I believe that the election was stolen from her using an array of these Republican schemes that all amount to voter suppression. We also now have the layer of bullshit about Russia hacked the DNC, the unproven claims that Russian hackers visited the websites of 21 state election agencies. They visited, but they didn't penetrate, if you read carefully the language that has been used. And so there is no determination by Republicans or Democrats, the victims, to fix our broken election system and to prevent hacking and manipulation by Americans, first and foremost, before we look at foreign culprits like Russia or Nigeria or China or Venezuela. And that's not going to happen. But on January 10th, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission is hosting an all-day summit, and they've invited experts from Homeland Security, secretaries of state, state and local election officials to come. And I'm sure they're going to talk about how to prevent Russian intrusion and Russian manipulation of the vote count. But there will be no focus on prevention of Americans interfering in our elections and trying to manipulate the result. And you hear the stories from time to time about how every vote counts. You've heard about this down-to-the-wire case in the House of Delegates in the Commonwealth of Virginia. After Democrats routed the Republican majority, it used to be 51-49. I'm sorry, it used to be a 32-seat Republican advantage. It's been narrowed 51-49. And today, they held the drawing to declare the winner in the race that was tied between David Yancey and his Democratic opponent. And David Yancey was selected the winner. Now, the challenger, Shelley Simons, who's a school board member in Newport News, last week had suggested before the drawing that they agree to forego what is a legally available option, a second recount, that can be called for by the loser of this drawing. But Yancey rejected that offer. Now he's won the drawing. And will Shelley Simons demand a second recount? Well, that could affect the organization of the lower house, who gets named speaker, who gets on the committees and all that. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. Earlier this week, Trump was trading braggadocio with Kim Jong-un about who's got the bigger nuclear button, and we know that's really a reference to penis size. And Trump has actually had to call back some of his bluffs. And he has agreed, at the request of South Korea's President Moon Jae-in, to postpone the joint military exercises planned by the U.S. and South Korea. And these will be delayed until after the Winter Olympics, being hosted in South Korea. And now North Korea is trying to get invited to the Olympics. And so this could lead to a de-escalation of the tensions. Now, the stipulation that South Korea had made was that he would ask the U.S. to postpone the military exercises, the war games, if North Korea agreed not to conduct any more missile or nuclear tests. We don't have any word about whether North Korea has, in fact, agreed to that, but this is the latest development in the struggle along the 38th parallel. Yesterday, I referenced that there's an economic analysis to the protests in Iran that certainly may be a major factor. And after years of secrecy, the budgets were released or somebody leaked them. And a lot of people who have, lost government subsidies, there have been price increases, I think, on fuel, they're complaining that those associated with the theocratic leadership are getting the pork while, I guess I can't use that in a Muslim setting, they're getting the money while the little people are suffering. And I noted that the denials of U.S. or Saudi Arabian or Israeli involvement in promoting these protests are something that I consider to be quite possible. Well, today in the New York Times, a curious piece bylined Margaret Coker in London goes to great lengths to try to prove a negative, trying to prove that the United States couldn't possibly be involved in promoting this protest in Iran. And so they say, while there has been no evidence that foreign governments orchestrated the protests, the Ayatollah and others have blamed foreign enemies for this upsurge in counteractivity. They quote, American intelligence officials and Iran watchers say the protests appear to have started organically. But we know that last June, Trump issued an executive order, and he ordered covert operations in Iran. We don't know the details of that finding, but you can imagine that my suspicions are aroused. So, let's see. Iran has accused Saudi Arabia of fomenting unrest. The head of Iran's National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, told a Lebanese television station the Saudis were responsible for 27% of all anti-Iran hashtags on Twitter. He asserted the hashtags and social media campaigns cornering the situation in Iran are all in fact being guided by Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, Israel, and the United States. Now that's his assertion. I can't prove it. I can't disprove it. But I'm inclined to believe it, just based on the history of U.S. covert actions in Iran. And we don't have to go all the way back to 1953 to find that thread. There was a lot of covert ops during the Obama administration, including the Stuxnet operation and the street-level assassination of many Iranian nuclear scientists. And finally today, I noted that California has ended prohibition of cannabis. And the Trump administration and Attorney General Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions III, they've decided to rescind the Obama-era policy of discouraging federal prosecutors from bringing charges of marijuana-related crimes in states that have legalized sales of cannabis. And we don't know the dimensions of this, but I will note that Cory Gardner, who is a Republican from Colorado, the first state, I believe, to legalize adult use of marijuana, he's pissed. He accused Sessions of violating promises that he had made during his confirmation or other hearings. He said, "This reported action directly contradicts what Sessions told me prior to his confirmation. With no notice to Congress, the Justice Department has trampled on the will of the voters in Colorado and other states. I'm prepared to take all steps necessary, including holding up nominees of the Department of Justice until the Attorney General lives up to the commitment he made prior to his confirmation." Well, I'll smoke one to that. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's available free, and you're free to share it with everybody. You can find it on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.